Mm-hmm. is so important, but then also having different projects that you're working on personally and artistically that are good outlets. Like, I've discovered that songwriting is a great outlet for me.
Nice.
So, you know, you can go home at the end of the day, even if you've had a bad audition or a lots of rejection, and mm-hmm. then, you know, put pen to paper, pick up a guitar, and finish something. But yeah, so much of it is just, you just keep going. And also just not taking things personally, because half of the business really isn't personal. You know, there's mm-hmm. there are so many talented people in that city. It's incredible. And the energy that you get from that is really amazing. But also just recognizing that so much of it is just, you know, if you fit the type, if... you know, you're there at the right time, if the right place, mm-hmm. and you know the right people, and it's not always a personal thing. So you just really can't take it personally.
So, and you branched out to this hotbed of musical environment here called Hunterdon County.
Yes.
And as it turns out, and Ken gave us a great history lesson about it last time he was here. It's been around for quite some time. How did you stumble upon Hunterdon Hills Playhouse, and what has your perception from the beginning to now been in getting involved in the Playhouse?
I stumbled early this summer.
Yeah.
And it was actually just through a friend told me they were looking for another singer for the show, and I submitted, and the director of the show, Don, called me and asked me if I wanted to be a part of it, and I literally walked into rehearsal a little late, a few days late, and what I learned from it is that it was just the family experience, you know? Our choreographer and our director and everyone that works at the Hunterdon Playhouse are just normal, family-loving people, and that's why I stuck around for this second show again, because, you know, I just had a good time, and it just felt like a home, so it felt good. So,
He was late to rehearsal because he was an emergency replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. After we had started rehearsing, so we saved our
saved your bacon. Huh?
Like, yeah, I'm coming.
When he's referring to Don, who's he talking about?
Don Amorosi directed this.
Oh,
movie.
Don's been there forever.
The last show, yeah, Don's been there. Yeah,
nice.
Mostly as a performer, but he's.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask you. Don has been a star performer there for years.
Yeah, I call him Boss Man, though.
I remember we've gone to, you're probably having your Christmas party.
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, my mom is flying in right now.
Good for you.
And she's going to be here for
excellent.
So, the holiday party.
And Don and the cast would all go sing in the other room by the big Christmas tree around the piano.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good stuff, man. No, that's awesome. So Don's gotten into directing. Excellent. This is how many plays has he gotten involved in?
I don't know.
Well, it's not his first, is what I guess.
No, it's not his first.
Yeah.
He's been doing it for the last 3 years now. Both of us have been kind of switching off.
USA Radio News.
Investigators continue to search for missing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. Kevin Winkler, Director of Investigative Operations for the Iowa Department of Public Safety, said tips are still continuing to come in.
Investigators from the Poweshiek County Sheriff's Office, the DCI, and the FBI continue to complete leads that have come in, as well as evaluate and prioritize new leads being received every day.
The economy added 157,000 jobs in July. The unemployment rate was down to 3.9%. Joni Courtney is the president and COO of EmployBridge. She talks about why that number of 156,000 is where it's at.
The job openings are there, and they're not finding the talent to meet the demand there. And I think that that is a big reason why we're not seeing a bigger number, because based on the demand, you would expect to see a number north of 200,000.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Your car's engine deals with pressures that can cause intense friction that can waste up to 10% of engine performance.
Power up with Castrol Edge with fluid titanium technology. It's 3 times stronger than leading oils against viscosity breakdown. Buy 5 quarts of Castrol Edge and a Purolator Boss filter for $32.99 at Advance or participating CarQuest Auto Parts stores.
3 times stronger based on Kurt Orban test. 5W30 is great.
When working at a growing business, you wear many hats. The new business hat, the buying toner for the copy machine hat, the sifting through tons of resumes hat. You can throw away that last hat thanks to Indeed.com. When posting your job, Indeed lets you add screener questions that give you a less time-consuming route to your short list of qualified candidates. So go ahead, dust off that extra long lunch hat. Hiring's better when you've got your short list. Save time on hiring when you post a job on Indeed. Get started today at Indeed.com/hire.
Joe Pappas, a man charged with murdering George H.W. Bush's former cardiologist, committed suicide today after being confronted by two members of the Houston Police Department. One of Pappas's former friends said he had a list and had planned more killings of people that bullied him back when he was in high school. Pappas also transferred his house deed the day before the killing as well. A well-known House Republican hopes to succeed a well-known Senate Republican. USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has that story.
Hoping to win the seat this November that's been held by Senator Bob Corker, who's retiring at the end of the year, Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn easily secured the Republican Senate nomination in a Thursday primary. She'll now go up against Democratic nominee and former Governor Phil Bredesen. If Blackburn wins, she'll be the first woman to represent the volunteer state in the U.S. Senate. Republican Corker announcing he's not seeking re-election, and since then, he's been a frequent critic of President Trump. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
This is USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
The TSA may stop passenger screening at more than 150 small and medium-sized airports with airplanes that seat fewer than 60 passengers. The proposal would allow the passengers to go through that smaller airport unscreened, but then once they arrive at a larger airport, they would have to be screened. President of Security Studies Group Jim Henson says this doesn't seem like a good idea to him.
As Secretary Kelly said, the terrorists have always focused on aircraft. I mean, if you can knock an airplane out of the sky or, as on 9/11, use them as weapons, you create a very normal fear for people. I mean, there's something completely not quite right about putting a couple hundred humans in an aluminum tube and hurtling them through the sky. We all have a rational fear of that. I mean, I can say that even though I've jumped out of them right at almost that same altitude. But the terrorists know that that puts fear in us, and disrupting that and our air travel system causes us massive disruption to the people and also to the businesses.
Hundreds of people have been evacuated from their homes in Lynchburg, Virginia, amid concerns that an aging dam might break. Tim Mitchell is the director of water resources for Lynchburg. He has an update on the situation.
We are pretty confident at this point that the dam is stable and safe. We are working on plans to do repairs to the dam and get people back to their homes as quickly as possible.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Audience, through all the noise out there today, consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR DB, the voice of business. Contact the chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com. And I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon on this, what can I say? Can't really call it a beautiful Friday. Certainly humid, and don't know where you are, but although they predicted heavy rain, 70% rain, I think most of us this afternoon in this area have had at least intermittent thunderstorms. I know that winds were fairly heavy in some areas. And right now, I'm sitting here at the chamber office in Flemington, and it's a beautiful, sunny, but very humid day. They said the high today was about 85 degrees. It certainly feels much warmer than that. Tonight, there's a prediction of about 80% chance of heavy rain and patchy fog. Into tomorrow morning, heavy rain and patchy fog, and then heavy rain. So about a 50% chance of heavy rain. Tomorrow does not look like the best day of the weekend. High of about 87 degrees. Slight chance of thunderstorms and patchy fog tomorrow night. Sunday does look, really the better day of the weekend. There are showers and possibly a thunderstorm, but mainly in the morning. Then a chance of thunderstorms afternoon. I'm sorry, that was Saturday. Excuse me. Sunday is patchy fog in the morning. However, it is supposed to be sunny in the afternoon and about 91 degrees. So let me revise that. Sunday is the day, patchy fog before 9 a.m., and all of us know if we live in these areas where there's a lot of fog, but in the afternoon it should be sunny. Mostly clear Sunday night, and then, of course, into Monday is mostly sunny. So then it looks like Sunday and Monday are the days if you're going to be able to go to the beach or get out there and do something fun outside. So I'm Pat Smits. It's Friday, a little after 4 p.m., and so then I'm here with It's the Law. And those of you who know me know that my practice is limited to family law matters. So I try to bring you up to date as to what is happening out there in the law. A little bit slow in the summer. Many of the judges are taking vacation, and so we don't get as many published cases. But let me see and let me tell you what has been going on. There's supposed to be a Supreme Court will hear arguments in September on whether the special master's findings and conclusions that failure to properly test and calibrate the ALCO test machine undermined the scientific reliability of breath tests. A big issue because the question is whether or not these tests are reliable. And, of course, that is going to be significant. I think the court will do what they can to try to find them reliable enough that they can be used. There have been some very interesting decisions over the years with respect to breathalyzers, with respect to whether or not the timing of giving the test makes a difference. There was a time where it was fairly easy to argue that if there had been about or more than an hour between the person being arrested and being given a breathalyzer test, that they would have to extrapolate back because within that hour the person's readings would be higher. Anyway, interesting area for those attorneys who handle it. New Jersey, of course, the first DWI is not criminal. However, really, we have a lot of penalties. Many people think that you can get a driver's license and drive during the day. That doesn't happen. So it's always important to have someone else drive. It doesn't make any sense because the fines, the punishment, the inconvenience. And it's fairly easy to get a DUI because of the It's now 0.08. For many years, it was 0.10. And now anyone who's really a heavy drinker probably is over a 0.08, certainly after a few drinks. So that's the situation there. There was a land use and planning case. Now, this was a Cherokee LPC land versus City of Linden Planning Board, and this is a New Jersey Supreme Court case, and they ruled, what the background of the case is, the tax lien holder appealed the dismissal of a complaint challenging the Planning Board's approval of a neighboring landowner's site plan and application. Plaintiff and owner of the tax sale certificates filed a complaint challenging the approval of a site plan application for development of a property. And what happened is the landowner argued they lacked standing, and the trial court dismissed the complaint because the tax lien holder was not considered an interested party. So the person who held the tax sale certificates for the property at the trial level was not considered an interested party. The plaintiffs then appealed, and the appellate division affirmed the dismissal, finding that a tax lien holder had no existing property interest in the property. And the lien holder argued that as holder of the tax sale certificates and as plaintiff in the foreclosure proceedings on the property, it had standing as an interested party. That's the, quote, interested party. And they argued that pursuant to a certain statute that they had, in fact, when they filed the complaint as a plaintiff in the foreclosure proceeding, they had standing. So the New Jersey Supreme Court found a tax lien holder could have standing to challenge a planning board's actions, since a tax lien holder had the right to acquire title to the property and the right to use the property in a limited manner. However, standing had to be considered on a case-by-case basis. So that means that other lien holders can't just use this automatically. That usually a case, obviously a case decided by the Supreme Court, applies to all future cases. But in this particular case, the Supreme Court said that standing had to be considered on a case-by-case basis. So the lien holders in this case alleged that the proposed project would eliminate access points to their property, interfere with an easement and modify stormwater management, and could affect their right to enter the property. Now, a dissent disagreed that the holder of a tax sale certificate had the right to acquire property within the meaning of the statute. So there was a dissent in that case. And that would have been, you know, a fairly significant case, and at least it's going to be a situation where anyone in that situation is going to have to not rely on that case, but they could certainly use the case, but they can't rely on it. So let me bring you a couple spots from our sponsors, and I'll be back with more legal news.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
In fact, one of the things we're doing is we're looking for additional members for the membership committee. And if you're not a member of the chamber, really look into it because there are a lot of benefits. And there are a lot of just great business people in this area who belong.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Well, hello again, and back to talking about some of the cases, and there was a class action by osteopaths, and that lawsuit, and that was filed by tens of thousands of osteopathic doctors against the American Osteopathic Association, alleging fraud and antitrust violations. And it's settled, so if anybody out there is interested, I'm sure you could contact the American Osteopathic Association to find out more about that case. Now, because it's not decided by a trial court, it would not be published as a case itself. It's just a settlement. Now, whether or not that is open to the public depends whether it was a confidential settlement or not. But I'm sure that anyone who is an osteopathic physician would be able to get that information. There was an electrician's assistant who just had a settlement. He settled a case for $3.69 million in Middlesex County. Now, you know, I think it's pretty common knowledge that Middlesex County would be a better county to sue in than Somerset or Hunterdon. But the point is, I can't imagine anyone who wants to be able to collect that amount of money because the person would have to be very seriously injured. And in fact, he was very seriously injured in an explosion while making repairs at a manufacturing facility. And so that, and they agreed to a settlement of $3.69 million in Middlesex County. The case is Shallow versus Park Electric. And that was done on July 24th. So that, you know, anybody could find out who the attorneys are and get as much information unless it's a confidential settlement. So there, what else? The U.S. Supreme Court has decided that they denied the Trump administration's efforts to block a climate change trial in a novel case brought by 21 children and teenagers from across the country. So that that case is going to be able to proceed. And it's a climate control. I find it just unbelievable that people don't believe in climate change. And this is a climate change case. So they, you know, it wasn't really climate control. It was climate change, if I misspoke. But they blocked or didn't block the effort, and there was an effort by the Trump administration, our government, to block that. And, of course, that means our money, our taxpayer money, paid, and who knows how much that was paid to handle that case. So in any event, what else is happening as far as published cases? And I always talk about published cases because they usually are they're the cases that must be filed unless it's a trial court. In other words, a trial court does not have to follow a decision of another trial judge. The appellate division certainly doesn't have to. And however, the appellate division and trial courts have to follow Supreme Court decisions, and trial courts have to follow the decisions of appellate cases as long as they're published. If they're unpublished, then it's not considered precedent setting. So there was a family law case in the interest of AA. Now, this in family part, they not only handle matrimonial cases, divorce cases, child custody, etc. It's also where delinquency cases are handled. Don't get me started on that. I believe that that was a mistake. I think when they created the family part and the civil part and criminal, that juvenile cases would be more appropriate under the criminal, in the criminal part. And that's because, there are always questions with older teenagers whether or not they're going to be allowed to proceed in family court or have to go up to criminal court. In this case, the decision was the appellate division, and the juvenile AA appealed from his adjudication of delinquencies for acts that, if he had committed by an adult, would constitute a second degree aggravated assault, and that would have been a lesser included offense of attempted murder. And then at the very least, he would have been charged with attempted murder, and a lesser charge would have been second-degree aggravated assault. And that is a lesser-included offense of attempted murder. And he would also be charged as an adult, if he was an adult, with possession of a firearm for unlawful purposes, unlawful possession of a weapon, and possession of a firearm by a minor. So the juvenile received a disposition to a two-year custodial term. And what happened is the police stopped AA and his companion after receiving reports that shooters had fled the scene on bicycles. And then one officer identified AA, that's the name, the pseudonym that they're using, as an individual near the scene just before the shooting. AA's mother arrived at the police station and, in the presence of detectives, asked AA if he was near the shooting. He confirmed that he was and stated that it was, quote, because they jumped us last week. Now, detectives had not read AA his Miranda warnings prior to his statement. So when someone is arrested for a criminal act, they're entitled and must be read their Miranda rights so they know that they don't have to say anything. So in this case, the trial court ruled that the statement made by AA was admissible, and the trial court ruled that the Miranda warnings were not necessary as the statement was not the product of police interrogation. Remember, it was his mother who asked him if he had been close to the robbery, the scene of the crime. So on appeal, AA challenged, among other issues, the admission of his statement to his mother. The appellate court reversed AA's adjudication and remanded the case for further proceedings. The appellate court rejected the state's argument that AA's statement was not the product of police interrogation. The appellate division held that the police use of a parent as a surrogate for an interrogation to produce an incriminatory statement violated the juvenile's rights. even though and even if the police did not intend to elicit the statement. So the court held, and this is the appellate division, that detectives should have known the possibility for A.A. and his mother's conversation to produce an incriminating statement, given the inherent pressure on a child to respond to a parent's questioning. So accordingly, the appellate division ruled that the detective's failure to give A.A. his Miranda warnings required suppression of his statement. So that's a significant case, and it needs to go out, and all police officers have to be aware that they can't use a parent as a surrogate to get this information, that they obviously would love a confession, and they felt that even though the incriminating statement was not a confession, it was they wanted to be able to use it and thought that it would be significant. And it certainly would have been because he admitted he was in the area and he was on a bike. Now, that didn't prove that he did it, but that certainly would be something that the prosecutor would want to get into evidence. So now there was a Supreme Court decision in criminal law. Now, isn't this interesting? The other decision was considered a family law decision because, in fact, the trial court was a family trial judge. And then it went up on appeal, but it's throughout considered family. Now, the next case that I'm telling you about was also published. It was State versus JLG. And this was it's actually a 62-page opinion by Chief Justice Rabner, and he wrote the opinion. So in this case, the defendant appealed from his conviction for sexual assault, and this was a convicted. He was convicted for sexual assault, endangering the welfare of a child, and witness tampering arising from a pattern of sexual abuse defendant had committed against her stepdaughter over an 18-month period. Defendant's stepdaughter testified that defendant threatened her at gunpoint not to reveal the abuse to anyone. When a family friend caught the defendant abusing his stepdaughter, now, so we're talking about the stepfather abusing the stepdaughter. So when the family friend caught defendant abusing his stepdaughter, her mother threatened to kill defendant, which led the victim to deny the abuse. Ultimately, the victim disclosed the abuse to her mother. At trial, defense counsel highlighted the lack of physical evidence and challenged the victim's credibility. The defendant also tried to bar the state's expert testimony concerning child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. And this is a very interesting, these studies are very interesting when a stepdaughter is, being abused by a step-parent or stepson being abused. So the trial court denied the motion to bar the state's expert's testimony, and the jury ultimately convicted the defendant on all counts. The defendant appealed again, challenging the admissibility of the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome testimony. And although the appellate division affirmed defendant's conviction, the court remanded the case to the trial court to conduct a hearing to determine whether child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome testimony met the reliability standard of Rule 702. In other words, the court has to rule whether or not testimony is going to be reliable enough to present it. So at the rehearing, went up to the appellate division, came back to the trial court, which is what usually happens. They get remanded. The cases from the appellate division are remanded to the trial court. And then What happened at the rehearing, the trial court concluded that the state failed to prove general acceptance of these child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. And so that, you know, that, and because of that, it didn't meet the standard of a rule of evidence 702. So the trial court then concluded that the state failed to provide the general acceptance of this testimony in relevant, except as to the delayed disclosure portion. And when I say delayed disclosure, that has to do with someone not reporting for years and for some reason then coming forward. Perhaps they no longer feel intimidated. There are a variety of reasons. So that the court found that relevant scientific experts generally accepted the concept that a significant portion of children delay reporting sexual abuse. So that the children who have been abused most often do not disclose it until later, and many times much later. However, the court ruled that expert testimony about the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome in general, or any of its component behaviors aside from delayed disclosure, would no longer be admissible in criminal trials. The court affirmed the defendant's conviction, ruling that although the jury did not need expert testimony to understand the victim's straightforward explanation for her delay in reporting defendant's abuse, the admission of the, and as a result of that, the admission of the expert testimony was harmless, considering the overwhelming evidence of defendant's guilt. So here, you know, basically they knew he, with all the evidence, they knew that it was reasonable to convict him. So even though in general they would say to the trial judges not to allow that child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome testimony in, just in general, although the judge, they basically said, no, you shouldn't have done it, but it isn't causing any harm. And so that was why. Now in other cases, at least until this case goes up or a case like it goes up to the Supreme Court, they're not, trial courts are not going to be able to, you know, admit this kind of testimony in general, except to explain why a child did not promptly report it. And that's significant. That is a significant part of that statute and the syndrome, and that is why there has been, you know, proof that children don't report. It's highly likely that they won't, especially if they're threatened with violence or their family is threatened with violence. That is, and I'm going off on a tangent, but that is why so many people are coming to the southern border. So many people have sent their children because of the violence, because of the fear, because of the critical nature of the threats and the fact that there's no question that these are threats. And in that those cases, there are times when some of it is sexual abuse and the child has not reported it until later, and at that point, the parents do what they can to get them out of the situation, and that usually means coming to the United States. So let me be back after telling you a little bit more about some of our sponsors, and we'll finish the program.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you...
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, we're back for a few more minutes, and then we'll go on to the sports guys. So there was a I don't have much other than the brief information that an appellate court this past, well, actually in the last week of July, affirmed a $525,000 award to a Clifton woman in a hostile workplace environment and unlawful retaliation suit against her employer. So that was pretty significant. If you know any military veterans that need legal help, the New Jersey State Bar Association has established the Military Legal Assistance Program. And this is a pro bono program. That means the attorney represents the client without charge, and it provides assistance to New Jersey residents who have served overseas as active duty members of reserve components of the Armed Forces, Armed Forces after September 11, 2001. So if you know anyone who needs legal assistance, you know, they should call the Bar Association in New Brunswick to make sure that they are qualified. This is a general program another way that attorneys are helping pro bono. I don't think anyone knows how much pro bono work many of us actually do. I'm involved now with going to be representing some of the teenagers who came over the border, either turned themselves in at the border or tried to come through without turning themselves in because they are now seeking either amnesty or status under a special provision that based on the fact that they're coming from violent areas. And most of these are not, they're not escaping violence of their family. They're really escaping violence from the gangs down in Latin America now are really, really a significant problem. Many countries, for example, where we were in Guatemala, most of the volunteers have been moved to only the northern area, the Indian communities, and yet even now there are many of the, well, if you're an American and going to Guatemala, you will have lots of warnings to not go to certain areas, certain towns. The city of Ciudad de Guatemala, Guatemala City, the Peace Corps volunteers cannot go into Guatemala City. They feel it's too dangerous. I mean, even though when I was there, we lived under military dictatorship. I mean, it was nothing compared to what is going on there now.
So there are, you know, lots of volunteer programs. As I said, there's KIND, K-I-N-D, Kids in Need of, Kids in Need of, it's representation, but I can't remember what the D is. It's been a long day. Now, there was a New Jersey appellate court has awarded a partial victory to an attorney being sued by the order of the Catholic Church for allegedly breaching the terms of a decades-old settlement agreement entered into by a parochial student by holding a media conference. This is the, I'm sure this is the Del Barton case, where Del Barton was sued and the attorney, there was obviously a confidentiality agreement, and the apparently the church said that the attorney now breached the, they're complaining that the attorney breached the terms of a decades-old settlement agreement that Del Barton entered into with the student because he held a media conference. So that is always a question. Of course, there was another case, and I have to read the full case, but I couldn't believe it. The parties in the terms of their property settlement agreement, they made specific provisions with respect to college for their children. And there's just been a case. I don't think it's been approved for publication, but they basically overturned it. So that, that's really a big concern for those of us who do family law. If you negotiate a settlement, why isn't it going to be enforced? So that is going to be a real concern for anyone. A dealer in the internet domain names, I'm sorry, it was a dealer in internet domain names is accused in by somebody that they were cyber squatting. So it's hard to, this is a cyber squatting suit, and basically saying that it was an illegal attempt to seize and to I guess I'm hesitating here. And anyway, it's an illegal attempt to seize on the posthumous popularity of Prince. So that apparently this was a domain trader in New Jersey, and they were accused of an illegal attempt to seize on popularity of Prince, and they must have had something. Sorry, I'm more than a little tired and don't have any more information on that. So there was a grandparent case, not published, so that's not a precedent from the standpoint you can't rely or cite that case. And very often those cases are not published because they're very specific to the parties. But in this case, the plaintiff was a grandfather. He appealed from his denial for visitation with his grandson. So what happened, and it's all initials, so that he was COM and the defendant was JOG-M. So she's, to make it easier, the defendant is, well, probably to make it more difficult, but JOG-M is the granddaughter. No, excuse me, is a daughter. And either daughter or son-in-law. And I don't think that... Let me go through the whole thing with you and we'll see whether it was his daughter or his daughter-in-law. In any event, the grandfather filed a pro se application for grandparent visitation rights. What that means is he didn't have an attorney. He filed this on his own. And it was he filed the pro se application for grandparents' visitation rights in the court. And after unsuccessful mediation, in other words, the parties tried to mediate, the court dismissed the application for grandparent visitation rights. And then the parties tried to mediate when they were unsuccessful. With that, the court dismissed the action without prejudice. Okay, let me see what else is happening here, and I'm going to come back because I want to take a look and make sure I didn't miss something.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Well, we're not going to the news quite yet, so let me play the other spot that I had planned on playing. Pushed the wrong button.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, as I was talking about this grandfather visitation, so the grandfather, at some point, the mother and her son moved out of his home. They had lived with her father, and so that was her father, not father-in-law. So they actually, the mother and son had lived with her father for a few months before she moved into her own home. Well, apparently the parties had a dispute, and the daughter decided she wasn't going to allow her son to visit the grandfather. Now, the statute in New Jersey, the burden of the grandparent who wants visitation over the objection of a child, it's a very significant burden. It's less of a burden if, in fact, the grandchild has lived with the grandparent. So in this case, apparently, they did live together for at least a short time, a few months. So the what happened is the grandfather filed the application, and then the parties tried to mediate a settlement, and that was unsuccessful. And then, as a result, when they came back to court, the court dismissed the action without prejudice. Now, thereafter, the grandfather retained an attorney and refiled his application. And so now the defendant then counterclaimed for attorney's fees because she claimed he filed a frivolous motion. Well, that and there is a possibility of getting counsel fees if it's a frivolous action. However, then the grandfather filed a motion seeking weekend visitation and scheduled, he also wanted to schedule video communication. So the court denied both the grandfather's request for parenting time and also the daughter's request for legal fees. So the grandfather argued the trial court failed to address the statutory factors and should have allowed discovery. The court found that the record supported the trial court's finding and determination that there was no evidence in which to that the defendant was not a fit parent or evidence that the grandfather had a psychological bond with the child that would be harmed unless they were allowed grandparenting time. So that's very important, whether or not there's going to be any harm and whether or not there was a psychological bond between the child and the grandfather because the parties had lived there. So it's very difficult, as I said, to get grandparent visitation unless the grandparents have had an extraordinary amount of time. Also, apparently the grandfather in that case, he contended that there should have been discovery allowed, and the court said no, that wasn't necessary either. Now, there's another case in family law that was not published, but I think it bears some discussion, and it'll do quickly. So in this case, the plaintiff appealed from an entry of a final judgment of divorce. So at trial, the plaintiff's husband expressed his concerns with his wife's mental health and her ability to co-parent the party's child. So the trial court heard testimony in that case and heard testimony from a joint custody expert who opined that defendant suffered from a delusional order. So what would happen is Gregory Joseph was called as a witness. He was, the attorneys could ask him questions, and especially the attorney who probably was concerned about his testimony. However, after the questioning, the joint custody expert, he gave an opinion that the defendant suffered from a delusional disorder focused on her unfounded suspicions. So that was what they found. And if he had sexually abused the party's child, the child was old enough to So the, at this point, the I'm sorry, I'm really losing it this afternoon. I'm so tired. So I'm going to just play the news. But in this case, they did have a joint custody expert. He opined that the defendant suffered from a delusional disorder focused on her unfounded suspicions that her husband had sexually abused the party's child and had sexually abused a child from a prior marriage who was also abusing the party's child and was attempting to poison the defendant.